and HD3 Urbana, a broadcast service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 22nd, 2009, at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a very special guest for you, someone who, if you've read his work, will need no introduction. If you haven't read it, you're going to want to. Matt Taibbi, a Rolling Stone columnist, political commentator, joining us today live on Media Matters for the full hour. It should be a terrific show. Before we go to Matt Taibbi, let's go now to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. After a five-year struggle against Bell South and Cox Cable, the town of Lafayette, Louisiana, began offering its new fiber-optic broadband service last week. The project, which is expected to be completed by 2011, will be the biggest publicly owned fiber network in the country. Attorney Jim Baller got involved in the fight for community internet in Lafayette in 2005 when Bell South pressured the Louisiana state legislature to block the project. The proposed law would have imposed a series of obstacles preventing the community from offering internet service that competed with the phone and cable companies. Then-Governor Kathleen Blanco all but locked Baller in a room with Bell South and Cox until they came up with a compromise.
The way we negotiated was to take each and every one of the provisions, line by line, go through it and say, this can't work. What are you doing, Bell South and Cox? Are you complying with anything like this yourself? And provision after provision, they responded that no, they weren't.
Even after the compromise, Bell South, now known as AT&T, continued to fight against the Lafayette project.
Bell South had a lapse of memory as to what it had agreed to in the bill, and it started a series of lawsuits that ended up tying up Lafayette in litigation over the course of the next two and a half years. And ultimately, the Supreme Court of Louisiana resolved the issue unanimously in Lafayette's favor, clearing the project to move forward.
Lafayette fiber broadband services will be faster and cheaper than the competition. With speeds ranging from 10 to 50 megabits per second, the 30 megabit per second tier costs $45. AT&T offers a maximum of 6 megabits per second for $43. The basic video tier includes 19 channels and costs $17. Customers are already subscribing to phone, television, and internet services through Lafayette Fiber.
Are corporate marketers preying on kids for profit? According to a new film, advertisers want to create consumers for life, and they're branding every aspect of childhood, from TV, toys, internet games and DVDs, to clothes and food. They're also encouraging children to sit in front of screens for several hours a day, with little regard for children's mental or physical health. Adriana Barbaro, producer of Consuming Kids, The Commercialization of Childhood, says the media may pose many health risks for children.
Some studies suggest that heavy television watching changes the way that the brain develops, and it's affecting children's ability to learn and leading to attention problems such as ADD and ADHD. There are many studies linking children's exposure to violence, to violent and aggressive behavior, and to anxiety and depression and to sleep problems in children.
Studies also show that marketing of junk food to children is escalating, and it's led to an epidemic of obesity in children.
So for the first time in modern times, children's life expectancies that are born today are shorter than that of their parents.
Aside from physical and mental health risks, she says, there is also a larger effect on society.
It's the values that kids are learning. There's the message that kids are getting over and over again at earlier and earlier ages is that it's about me. It's about me now, instant gratification, material values in the sense that what you are and what you own and what you buy defines you. So it's really a disservice to kids because we're teaching them to look outside of themselves for happiness and satisfaction. And so they're always going to be chasing after the next, you know, greatest and latest thing.
Barbaro says that everyone must get involved to change marketing practices to children.
So many parents, just from the research I've done, are seeing changes in their kids. And a lot of times they're not linking it and don't recognize that what kids are putting in their body in terms of their media diet is just as important as the food they're getting in their body and the exercise or whatever else that they're doing, that your media diet has an effect on you. There's a connection. And if you're concerned with the junk food or if you're concerned with the precocious sexuality or the violence in the media, that it's one industry selling all of these things to your kids. They're undermining your job. They're making your job as a parent, which is already so hard, harder. As a community, we need to support parents, and we really need to support our children. They deserve better.
For more information about consuming kids, visit the Media Education Foundation at mediaed.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you live today, February 22nd, 2009. Our guest today is Matt Taibbi, the journalist and political writer. Taibbi works at Rolling Stone magazine, where he authors a column called Road Rage for the print version, and also has a weekly online column called The Low Post. You've probably seen him. Possibly on TV or read his work. He has been a regular contributor to the HBO program Real Time with Bill Maher. For those of you who haven't read his work, if you like this program, you should be reading Matt Taibbi. He's one of the best writers we have going in journalism today, one of the most entertaining and most provocative. And it's my pleasure to welcome him today to Media Matters. Matt Taibbi, welcome. Hello, Matt.
Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah,
I hear you beautifully. It's great to hear your voice. First of all, Matt, before we get into some of the issues of the day that you've been writing about, one of the things that's striking as I was doing some research for the program is your background. I don't think there's any journalist in America that I know of, that certainly we've ever had on this program in the past 6 years, who has a background like yours. And just if you wouldn't mind to take 30 seconds or a minute just to recount your path to where you are today from where you were, say, when you got out of college 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I have a little bit of an unusual path to getting a job and a paying job in journalism. I actually finished school in Russia, in St. Petersburg, Russia, and just stayed and freelanced for a while. But I, in between working for a newspaper called the Moscow Times in Moscow and freelancing in St. Petersburg, I had a couple of experiences. I played pro baseball for the Red Army. I think I'm actually the only American ever to be commissioned into the Red Army, because you had, at that time, you had to actually be in the Army in order to play for their sports teams. I played pro basketball in Mongolia. I also played for the Uzbek national baseball team.
What's the caliber of baseball in Uzbekistan?
It was pretty weak, actually. The really funny thing about it was that I think the team that I was on, at one point it was me and 9 Cuban exchange students. I don't think there was a single Uzbek on the team. And I remember one game we played against the Kyrgyz national team. We played in a pasture, and we had ground rules that if you hit a sheep in the outfield, it was a triple, and if you hit a cow, it was a double. That's how remote it was, so... Yeah, I had some weird experiences on the road back to here.
And then, how long have you been at Rolling Stone?
About 4.5 years now. I mean, I returned to the States in 2002 from Moscow, and they had done a story on a newspaper that I had in Moscow called The Exile. So when I got back to the States, they got in touch with me, and what ended up happening was that I ended up covering the 2004 presidential campaign for them, and I've been working for them ever since.
You know, you hear these horror stories, and we'll talk about it perhaps later in the show, about the decline of newspapers and print media and traditional media, with advertisers and readers and viewers disappearing. How's Rolling Stone holding up in all this?
Well, you know, we're an interesting case for a number of reasons. You know, one of the things that's unique about Rolling Stone is that it's a wholly privately owned media organization. In other words, we're not a corporation. We're owned by an individual, Jan Wenner, which gives us a little bit of leeway, I would say, creatively to do some things that normal news organizations can't do. But, you know, we've had a lot of the same issues that everybody else has. Our circulation actually has gone up in the last two years. And I think this year, I believe it went up significantly. But I think, you know, because the advertising revenue has gone down, which is the case all across the board, you know, we've had to cut the size of the magazine from its traditional sort of giant-sized look to a standard magazine format this year. And, you know, that was a big change for us. But, you know, this is something that's going on all across the business because especially, you know, web advertising is so quantifiable. You can see exactly how effective your advertising is. And print advertising just doesn't have that same, you know, bang for the buck that you get with web advertising or TV advertising. So I think it's suffering across the board, and that's one of the reasons that print advertising print organizations are suffering so badly, because it's just so hard to measure how well they're doing.
Yeah, I would imagine off the top of my head that having a private owner like Jenner not accountable to shareholders and basically able to do as he pleases, as long as, you know, he's happy with the situation and he can pay his bills, permits you perhaps somewhat more political latitude than might be the case at another commercial news medium, since as far as I can tell, Jenner's political views aren't that far from yours.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the job that I have at Rolling Stone is anomalous in a number of ways. Number one, you know, we can be as you know, profane as we want in the use of language. We can be, you know, wildly kind of digressive and creative and do all kinds of crazy things in print, and you can't do that in a normal news organization or you know, a major corporate magazine. But you know, politically, obviously, Jan has some concrete political views, which, you know, allows us to be a little bit more, I would say, a little bit more radical than other magazines are allowed to be, just because, you know, I think a lot of magazines kind of shy away from taking extremely controversial positions on things just because they, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders and they want to make as much money as possible. And, you know, in our case, Jan has not been afraid to kind of seem overtly political or seem overtly, you know, to be favoring one side or another. And that's kind of allowed us to have a little bit more editorial freedom.
You know, Matt Taibbi, you've covered the last couple of presidential races, and your writing, I think, has gotten a lot of attention. It's terrific stuff. Again, I urge our readers to go online and check it out if they're not familiar with it. What is your take so far, a month into it, roughly, into the new administration, of the Obama administration? And is it what you expected last fall and during the presidential race?
It's about what I expected. I was always very surprised when I met people who were very radical politically, who had very high expectations for what was going to happen in an Obama administration. I think a lot of people thought that this guy was going to come in and he was going to be, you know, some radical progressive or, you know, radical leftist or something like that. And my take on Obama all along was that he was very much a middle-of-the-road Democrat. He's an extraordinarily talented politician, and he has this unbelievable ability to galvanize voters and to create attention and to rally, you know, rally people and unify his base. But, you know, as a politician, I always thought that he was very much a typical middle-of-the-road Democrat, and that's kind of what he's proven to be. Most of his appointments have been, you know, people who were straight out of the Clinton administration, or, you know, from the party hierarchy. And I think, you know, some people are very disappointed that he picked people like Tom Daschle, or that he was considering people like John Brennan for the post, the CIA post, and or that, you know, for instance, this past week there was news that they essentially, you know, reaffirmed the rendition policy, where we can take people and bring them to foreign countries where the human rights standards are less stringent. You know, a lot of people expected that policy was going to be reversed. It wasn't. But this is kind of what I personally kind of expected this. But, you know, so it's hard to say, though, how effective it's all going to be. And, you know, he's in an unprecedented crisis, so, you know, we'll see how that all pans out.
Yeah, unprecedented crisis indeed. Let's talk a little bit about that. What is your sense of the nature, how deep this crisis is? I mean, I think right now, to put a little context to that question, when I see journalists talking about this or pundits talking about it, everyone says, yeah, this is a really serious crisis, but I think they're still groping to sort of understand what exactly does that mean. It's sort of like we're at the edge of a cliff and no one knows how deep it is once you fall over it. What's your take on how serious this crisis is in historical terms?
I don't think there's any way to understate exactly where we are right now. I think this is this crisis is going to kind of push us to ask all kinds of very fundamental questions about what kind of society this is going to be, and by that I mean, you know, is this going to be a capitalist society? Is it going to be some kind of you know, quasi oligarchical pseudo capitalist state-run, you know, economy? It's. I think we're sort of morphing organically in a direction that has never been seen before. Just because what happened really with this crisis was that because of progressive deregulation over the years, and because, you know, these banking companies were allowed to effect these enormous mergers, you know, like the Citigroup merger, you know, with Travelers and Smith Barney and Citibank all merging, these companies became so enormous and so unwieldy that they acquired sort of massive political power just by virtue of their size, and they all proved to be so big that the government couldn't just let them fail when they all made these terrible mistakes in the last 5 or 6 years with the housing market. And what's happened now as a result of that is that the government has been forced to step in and kind of affect its own merger with these companies. And now the result of that is that we have this enormous sort of bureaucracy that consists in part of the Fed and part of the Treasury and part of, you know, these enormous companies like Bank of America and Citi, and it's also like sort of one gigantic organism, and nobody knows what it is really, and nobody knows how to govern it or what to do with it, and it's terrifying because nobody really knows what to do or how to get us out of the situation, and it's, you know, everybody that I talk to in Congress is absolutely petrified. They think that it can get a lot worse before it can get better, and I haven't heard anybody seeming optimistic at all. So, yeah, I think it's horrifying.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Matt Taibbi, you've just been listening to, writer for Rolling Stone magazine, graciously joining us live. So if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Matt Taibbi, the telephone number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I am Bob McChesney, your host. Matt, you know, one of the big deals that's gone down in the last couple of weeks has been the stimulus package, the stimulus bill, which was, you know, like, I think you're, to follow up your point, it was extraordinary and I think unprecedented sort of measure, at least in my lifetime, for Congress to be considering and to be passing, the sort of sums we're talking about. And there's also been work by Secretary of Treasury Geithner on the dealing with the financial institutions and the crisis of the banks and the prospect growing, it seems, of nationalizing the banks.
Right.
You cover politics again. What is your sense of the stimulus bill? Do you have confidence that this is the sort of thing that's heading in the right direction? That this will be effective? Do people in Congress feel that way?
Well, you know, the traditional economic theories, you know, I guess, and again, I have to stress that I don't have a finance background. Before all this started blowing up, I didn't know a thing about economics. So, you know, whatever I say, I have to take with a grain of salt. But from what I understand, you know, traditional economic theory stresses that when, you know, the credit markets get tightened and there's not enough lending, that the thing to do is to have the government inject a lot of money into the economy. And so I think with the stimulus bill, I think they're just kind of going by the book there, that they're hoping to just dump an enormous amount of money into the economy and hope that somehow stimulates economic activity and provides some people with jobs. But I don't think the stimulus bill or TARP is nearly as significant as what's going on, for instance, with, you know, the Fed. You know, while we're spending $700 billion on TARP and, you know, a similar amount on the stimulus package, the Fed has been lending out trillions and trillions of dollars and guaranteeing trillions more in private loans, sort of secretly outside the reach of Congress, and nobody knows where that money's going and who's getting it and in what amounts. And it's almost like a shadow bailout program that's going on that nobody's even aware of. And I think there's a lot of people who are very frightened that, you know, that money is going to at some point just sort of all start pouring into the economy, and then we'll end up with a hyperinflationary kind of situation, which would be, you know, an even bigger disaster that we're in right now. So, you know, to answer your question, I don't really know where the stimulus package is going to work yet, but it just seems like a drop in the bucket compared to what else is going on.
You know, it seems to me, when you were talking about the Fed and what it's doing with these trillions of dollars, that it harkens back to what happened in the fall when Paulson, Bush's Treasury Secretary, got sort of given the $300 billion to play with without any strings attached, basically. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense mostly is that this money was just sort of given without any conditions to banks, and they used it to bail out their shareholders and their CEOs and sort of cover their tails. And is there any reason not to think that that's more or less what the Fed's doing? It's helping out wealthy people and investors, and not really necessarily, if it helps out the American people, that's sort of collateral.
The really irritating part about all that is that there's no way to tell. You know, it could be, you know, for instance, with TARP, the real problem with TARP was that first tranche of TARP was that they didn't measure what happened to the money after they gave it away. They made sure that everybody who got the money was a healthy bank. In other words, that they weren't giving the money to banks that were about to collapse otherwise. They were giving the money to banks that were strong enough to survive, but they didn't require that they lend money after they got it. So basically what they were doing was giving money to healthy banks so that they could hold on to it. And this is, you know, $350 billion worth of money, and so they basically injected a whole bunch of money into their balance sheet and held on to it, and that shored up, I guess, the value of you know, the shareholders' assets in the company. And the banks will argue that that's necessary, that they need to have that kind of security in their balance sheet in order to lend out in the future. But, you know, it also could be that they're just taking a whole bunch of money from the government so that, you know, that their share price doesn't go down. But it's impossible to measure. It could be one thing and it could be the other thing, and we have no way of knowing, which is kind of not the way you want to be approaching problems when you're dealing with giving away $300 billion. Normally, you want to have some way to measure the success of your program, and we have no way of measuring the success of any of these programs, which is the real problem.
Well, you know, you see during the campaign trail, politicians like John McCain getting his panties in a bunch over, like, you know, $100,000 misspent on ketchup.
Oh, yeah.
And then you're wondering, you know, what's all this stuff these guys are whining about when suddenly they just sort of look the other way and hand out $300 billion?
Yeah, I talked to Senator Sanders from Vermont the other day, and he's saying, yeah, you know, we have to have 2 hours of meetings before we can even talk about giving away $5 million in the Senate, and here's the Fed giving away trillions of dollars a month, you know, or, you know, the Treasury under TARP just sort of handing away, you know, tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, and this stuff is just all being kind of dumped out there exclusively of the normal appropriations process. In other words, the normal appropriations process requires that when we give away federal money, that you have to go through all these hoops. You have to make sure that there's no conflicts of interest, that the lobbying has been kept to a minimum, and it's a very, very strict procedure for all that. But with this, with TARP and with the lending that the Fed is doing, there's absolutely no oversight and no procedure or nothing. They just kind of hand away chunks of money, and it's usually one or two people. You know, it's Ben Bernanke or whoever at the Fed giving out the money, or it's, you know, Henry Paulson or Geithner just administering this TARP money. And it's an enormous concentration of not only financial but political power in the hands of just a couple of people.
You know, you'd like to think, Matt Taibbi, that what remains of our news media in this country, at the New York Times and Washington Post, the cable news networks, the Wall Street Journal, would have teams of their absolute premier reporters and investigative journalists doing nothing but trying to get to the bottom of this, that there, you know, there'd be literally hundreds of brilliant journalists getting to the bottom of this issue. Is that going on?
No. The scary part about that is that doesn't go on normally. I remember 2 or 3 years ago being in the Senate when they passed an omnibus appropriations bill where, I don't know, it was probably $1.5 billion was being spent, and I was the only reporter in the gallery. And I'm not gonna say that I'm normally there, you know, to cover what happens when the government spends the money, but there's normally not a whole lot of people who even cover the normal appropriations process in this country. But now we have this kind of shadow appropriations process, this enormous multi-tiered, multi-pronged bailout that's going on. And the problem is that, you know, not only is there nobody looking at it, but I think even if there were people in the mainstream media looking at this, they wouldn't understand it because it's so complicated that you have to have studied these issues for months at a time just to have even a baseline understanding of how this whole process works. I mean, nobody knows how the Fed works. And nobody knows how they're evaluating the assets that the Fed is apparently buying from these banks. And it's just an enormously complicated, complex subject, and nobody's looking at it. So it's very, very depressing.
Our guest, Matt Taibbi, writer for Rolling Stone magazine, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open at 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Matt Taibbi, one of the areas you write about, at length, is, of course, the Republican Party, its candidates, and its prospects. And to my knowledge, and I've asked a couple of political scientist friends of mine this question, and they sort of confirmed it to the best of their knowledge, no major political party has had its butt kicked twice in a row like the Republican Party has in 2006 and 2008, unless you go as far back as the 1930s and the demolition of the Republicans during the New Deal. And during the stimulus debates, it basically lined up entirely opposed to the Obama administration.
Yeah.
What is the future of this party?
Well, I think it's difficult to say. One of the things that was I thought very significant with the election of Barack Obama is that the party really lost its ability to win using racial politics, and that was a major part of the Republican Party's strength. I mean, if you go back to the late 60s when Richard Nixon took the South away from the Democrats by pursuing his so-called Southern strategy, which was basically to show a lot of scary pictures of, you know, urban black America in commercials to Southern whites. That was how the Republicans kind of seized the majority in this country by, using racial politics. And they did it over and over and over again through, you know, the Willie Horton ad, or, you know, Reagan bashing welfare queens, or the immigration debate, and, you know, all that stuff. It always came up, but this time it really backfired tremendously on the Republican Party. And, you know, I think it not only didn't win them votes, I think it lost to them an enormous amount of support. And so they're in a state right now where they have to figure out how they're gonna get their base back. And they're not really sure what they're going to do. Clearly, the short-term strategy is to be completely obfuscatory and line up and close ranks to oppose everything that Obama does, but that's going to consign them almost completely to irrelevance in the short term, because the Democratic Party doesn't really need them to pass anything. So obviously they're using people like Tim Pawlenty right now to be their spokesmen, and people who haven't been associated with the Bush administration or with the new right in the last 20 years. And they're sort of groping around for a new face and a new new ideology, but they clearly haven't found it yet. So I you know, it's hard to say where they're going to go from here, but they always seem to come back. So you know, we'll have to see what they come up with.
You know, one of the things Matt Taibbi has found interesting is the obsession with the notion of bipartisanship over the last month. And the reason why I found it interesting is I don't recall in 2001 or 2005, after Bush barely won in 2000, won a close one in 2004 and lost the popular vote by about 500,000 or 600,000 in 2000. I don't recall the same chorus of pundits demanding, you know, bipartisanship.
Yeah, well, no, that was the hallmark of the Bush method, the Bush, you know, delay method of pushing legislation into law. They worked very hard always to pass bills with the minimum amount of support needed. What they would do is they would take a bill like CAFTA, and they would make it, you know,
the Central America Free Trade Agreement.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they would absolutely concede nothing to the other side, and even if they didn't have the votes, they would just keep the vote open really late and you know, call up the dissenting members and bully them into voting their way. I remember there was one vote where they called up some congressman and threatened to run a candidate against his son in some election somewhere. I mean, that was the way the Republicans operated. They didn't give an inch, and they took the minimum amount of support they needed to pass their bills, and they got what they wanted without having to reach out to the other side. And everybody back then saluted that as very hardcore, tough politics and fighting for their own agenda. And now it seems like, you get sort of the opposite calls in the media, and I'm not really sure what that's all about, but that's definitely true.
Our guest, Matt Taibbi. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Matt Taibbi writes for Rolling Stone magazine. The phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently, so let's go to the phone lines right now. Let's start with line 4, who's on a cell phone. Greetings, you're on the air with Matt Taibbi.
Hello, Matt.
Hello.
I've got a question for you. As a journalist, back when Bernanke first pulled the plug on the economy in the fall, yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
When Bernanke first attempted to control the economy by pulling the plug on it and short-circuiting the market on a day back last fall, it was, according to one news source I heard, because someone had tried to tap out $500 billion from the money market.
I don't know what you're referring. I'm sorry, I don't know what you're referring to. Back in the fall, you mean back around the time of the AIG bailout, or what was that?
Is there anything more to it, sir? I think we've lost that caller, Matt. So I think we'll have to leave that one in hanging in the air.
Okay.
Let's go to another caller now. Line 1, you're on the air with Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine.
Hello, Matt.
Hello.
Hey, I just want to say I'm a big fan. I have a subscription to Rolling Stone, and your stuff is great, and it's hilarious, and I love your stuff.
Oh,
but my question is, I'm a union member, and I wonder what are your thoughts on the chance of the Employee Free Choice Act passing? And I'm going to call and listen to your answer.
And you know, Matt, before you do answer that exactly, maybe just explain what the Employee Free Choice Act is.
Is this the one where they're going to change the voting rules?
Yeah, okay. Then I'll explain it then. It's the law that would allow workers to form unions like they were able to before Taft-Hartley, which is a majority of them sign up, they want a union, they automatically get a union. The same, it's the way you can get out of a union. If a majority of workers want to get out of a union and they sign a card, the union ends immediately. And so they're just trying to make it easier for workers to get into unions, as easy to get into them as it is to get out of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think this is going to be another one of those things that where people thought that that Obama was elected and that there was going to be this enormous flowering of progressive legislation. But I seem to be hearing from a lot of people who are disappointed and who are thinking that these changes aren't going to be made. So. For instance, there was the bankruptcy bill. Everybody was kind of hoping that they were going to roll back some of the aspects of the 2005 bankruptcy bill, and they backed away from that too. So I don't know. I mean, unfortunately, I'm not as familiar with that as maybe I should be, but my guess would be probably not.
Our guest, Matt Tavey. Matt, you've also written about what's going on in Minnesota, which I find very bizarre. How long does it take up in Minnesota in this Senate race to sort of just declare one person or the other the winner? I mean, they have to give every lawyer in Minnesota a job first?
Yeah, well, they're talking now about this maybe being continuing on through the summer. For people who haven't heard about this, this race between Norm Coleman and Al Franken has been... it's been tied up in various court challenges since November, and they've done a recount, and I guess that Franken has been declared to be something like 226 votes ahead, I think it is, at last count. Mm-hmm. But Coleman is still trying to get a whole bunch of absentee ballots considered. But there was a major, he had a major setback, I guess just the other day when the judge ruled that, out of 19,000 absentee ballots that he wanted considered, he threw away 12,000 of them right off hand. And so that leaves him with only 7,000. And of those, only a small percentage are going to be changed. And even of that percentage, he needs to still make up that 200 vote difference in order for him to come out, ahead. So people, at this point, Coleman really can't win, but what they can do is they can tie this whole business up almost indefinitely with legal challenges, and I think that's going to be the strategy because that will keep the Democrats from having an extra vote in the Senate for as long as possible. And so they're going to kind of do the four-corner offense at this point and just slow down the whole thing for as long as they can.
And is there anything that the state of Minnesota can do to get a senator in the Senate if they think someone actually won the election? Or is this a strategy anyone can use now, just a horse around to keep people out of office?
Well, again, I don't think Minnesota senator, is going to want to accelerate that process. Yeah, cause he's a Republican, obviously. And so there's really nothing that anybody can do. The process has to play itself out in the courts, and there's not a whole lot, from what I understand, is that anybody can do to accelerate any of this. It's gonna go on as long as Coleman and the Republican Party continue to fight every single ruling. So until he concedes, this thing is going to keep going probably through the end of the summer, I would guess.
Our guest, Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Matt, you wrote a lot about the Democratic primary race for president last year leading up to the convention. And, one of the things that was interesting in that process, and you wrote about it, was, Barack Obama really used his opposition to the Iraq War to be the main thing that distinguished him from Hillary Clinton.
Right.
So he really was able to outflank her on the left and collect all the anti-war votes, which is significant in the Democratic Party, obviously, and leave her sort of struggling then for a message that didn't make her sound like she was just the establishment candidate.
Right.
And then as soon as he sort of got those votes, it seemed like he became the war candidate. What was going on there?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was just reading Obama, this, I guess just yesterday or today, released this plan that he wants to reduce the size of the annual federal deficit from $1.3 trillion to about half that. And they were, what they were going to do to affect that that change by the year 2013 was to reduce Iraq war spending. So, but, you know, reading between the lines, that means that they're still planning on spending an enormous amount of money on the Iraq war still through 2013, which came as kind of a shock to me because I thought, like a lot of people, that Barack Obama was going to be the guy who was going to go in and maybe wind up that whole situation in Iraq. But it sure doesn't look like that. And, again, this is just another one of those things that I think people are going to come to grips with, that they're expecting huge changes in policy, they're probably not going to get them. I mean, if you look at the appointments that Obama made, and you know, retaining Robert Gates and you know, hoping to bring Brennan back, although that didn't pan out, and putting Hillary Clinton in charge of foreign policy, it looks, you know, it looks like they're going to kind of pursue a status quo, you know, kind of policy in Iraq and not affect any kind of rapid withdrawal from there, which to me seems crazy, especially considering that we're in such dire financial straits. Why would we want to continue, you know, pouring gasoline on that financial fire over there, in addition to it being morally wrong? You know, just practically it's insane. But
and if I can add one other ingredient to that, I don't get the sense there's a groundswell of popular support demanding that we ramp up or maintain all these wars over there.
No, I mean, I think people at this point, like, you know, are afraid they're not going to have money, you know, to last them out the week. The last thing they want to do is commit billions of dollars to build schools in the, you know, hand out soccer balls in the Anbar province or whatever it is that we're doing. You know, I mean, our priorities have gotten so completely out of whack. And for a while, everybody was fat and happy on the housing bubble. They kind of didn't mind the idea that we were, you know, building hockey rinks in Baghdad or whatever it was that we were doing. But now that we're in this trouble and we're having this crisis, I don't think anybody has a stomach for an extended stay over there. You know, in addition to the fact that we still have large numbers of people getting killed and maimed over there for no reason. It's just completely crazy, and I personally don't understand it. I mean, I would think the Democrats, as much as they could be blamed for voting for the war back in 2002, 2003, that I thought that was just cynical politics, that they were afraid of looking weak going into the 2004 elections, and that's why they did that. But I thought they were just being cynical and pragmatic. But there's no cynical, pragmatic reason to stay in Iraq now. I just don't get why they're not trying to withdraw from there now. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Our guest, Matt Tavey, you're listening to Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Charleston, you're on the air with Matt Tavey of Rolling Stone magazine.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to make an observation. That is, a lot of people are talking about the demise of the Republican Party and that things are going poorly for them, but I think it's overlooking the fact that over the past couple decades, the key constituencies of the Republicans have amassed a huge amount of wealth and have changed the rules sufficiently that they can very easily turn that into political capital. And frankly, even if Obama increases the tax rate to 39% or capital gains to 20%, you know, it's only really chipping away at their power, and it's done nothing to, you know, lessen the capital they've accumulated. And as long as that's the case, I think the Republicans can afford to do what they're doing now and write it out. And then if maybe it takes 8 or maybe even 12 years, they're going to be back running the game. So I'd like to hear you convince me that I'm wrong in that. So I'll hang on.
Are you saying that the Republicans' base is, you know, sort of wealthy corporate America? Is that the idea?
Well, corporate America and some other elites. So maybe a few Republican politicians might be in trouble. But I think the Republican Party itself has amassed huge gains, and it's this is just a temporary setback.
Well, you have to look
at it. Thank you, caller.
Yeah, from a couple of different angles. Obviously, there's a financial elite in this country that, and I don't think that they uniformly support the Republican Party. I think if they had their druthers, they'd probably prefer the Republican Party. But and because it's more openly in favor of deregulation and sort of laissez-faire politics, but they don't really have a problem with the Democratic Party either. I mean, if you remember correctly, the Democrats, have also pursued a lot of policies that were very friendly to Wall Street and corporate America in the last 15, 20 years. I think the real issue with the Republican Party is not so much their financial base, but their electoral base, which is shrinking, because they really rose to prominence because they had dominated the sort of middle class, middle American, working to middle class white voters. But those voters are becoming a smaller and smaller percentage of the American electorate, and that process is not going to go backwards. It's going to go the other direction. And I think as time goes on, they're going to have a harder time winning nationwide elections just because they're going to have a tougher time getting that extra percentage they're losing as the demographic battle swings sort of more in the direction of the Democrats. So I think that's their problem going forward, is not so much financially but politically. They have to find a new message that they can spread that's going to get them large numbers of voters again.
You know, Matt, you've talked already about sort of the link to sort of, for lack of a better term, white supremacist or racist, that is being, or racial themes, not to be too pejorative, as being a key element to Republican electoral success. You've also written about the religious right and religious movements, and one of the most entertaining pieces you wrote was a trip you took to one of these fundamentalist religious camps,
right,
and your experience there. And I urge listeners to go online, and if you go to Matt Taibbi and look up, go online, you'll be able to find it soon enough. What is your sense of the religious right politically? 10, 15, 20 years ago, even 5 years ago, I think liberals and progressives who on the left were obsessed that this was a group that was going to have some sort of jihad over our culture. Do you think that is the same today, or is their role changing?
Well, they still have an enormous stranglehold over the Republican Party. I think we saw that with what happened with John McCain this summer, is that he had a real difficult time as a candidate. The Republicans, I think, wanted, they knew that they were going to have trouble going into 2008, and I think they wanted to nominate somebody who was a little bit more middle of the road, a little bit more of a quote-unquote centrist, although I hate that word. It sort of made sense in the beginning when McCain ended up being the nominee, but he's so offended that fundamentalist religious right wing of their party that they ended up having to swing back in that direction with the nomination of Sarah Palin. It ended up being a completely schizophrenic ticket, and that really hurt the Republicans, I think, in November. I think they really had a tough time selling a unified message. And the problem was that they were, on the one hand, trying to whip up the base with Sarah Palin, and on the other hand, trying to reach out to swing voters with John McCain, and that really crippled them. I think they scared away those voters in the middle with the people who were ranting and raving at Palin's rallies. And that's going to be a problem for them going forward, because that 25 to 30% of the country that is part of the religious right or conservative and religious, is they're not going to go away. They're sort of like an insoluble voting block, but it's very, very hard to reconcile those people with kind of a centrist political party. And so the Republicans don't really have a way of doing that, and that's one of their problems going forward. They haven't figured out a way to affect that merger and present a unified ticket going forward.
It's sort of interesting that you look at the founders of this country, and politely they're called deists, but they were not religious in the contemporary sense of the term that we demand of our politicians. And it's sort of interesting that we've gone in that direction, that we've gone from an era in which people could be, not profess great spiritual beliefs and metaphysical beliefs and be the founders of a country, to a point where all politicians have to almost speak in tongues now to be taken seriously as a candidate.
Yeah, no, it's become a real political litmus test. And I remember I was covering McCain last summer when this started to become an issue. There were a lot of whispers going around that McCain was losing his base, and there were a lot of prominent leaders in the religious right who were threatening to pull their support. And I remember being on McCain's plane, and suddenly they started coming up to us. You know, they have staffers from the campaign coming up and down the aisle of the plane on Thursdays and Fridays saying, oh, by the way, you know, Senator McCain is going to be worshiping this weekend at his church, as he usually does. And we were sort of all, you know, given the hint that we were supposed to go check in and see that he was actually worshiping. Well, you know, he hadn't been doing that until then. And, you know, from what we understood, he hadn't really been going to church at all. Up until that point in the campaign, this was about June or July. But they realized that nowadays, when you run for president, and especially when you're a Republican running for president, you have to be seen, you know, in the act of worship, or else you're not going to be a viable candidate. That's something that's kind of new in this country, I think. Obviously, it was a big part of Jimmy Carter's campaign. It was a big part of some other presidential candidates. But now it's a thing that everybody has to do.
I mean, they didn't demand that Herbert Hoover sort of, you know, start belting out spirituals. And,
Exactly.
That was the last thing anyone cared about, I thought. But at any rate, let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest, Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine. Let's go now to line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Matt Taibbi.
Yeah, I actually have a question, but I'll just to note something. I was raised in a fundamentalist family, and I know these people very well, and something that's interesting about that culture is I think it goes quite a ways back to right after the Civil War, and my grandmother was in the WCTU, I think it was, Christian Temperance Union, and she told me that they knew the Ku Klux Klan, for example, and she would say, oh, they're not that bad of people, and so on, and I was flabbergasted as a child that my grandmother was telling this. But I think the whole racial politics issue with that segment of society is related to the core of the Republican Party as it's developed at this point. And I think that they're dead. I mean, you know, that's the only thing going for Obama is, like, where can he go wrong? I mean, the problem with Obama is, I mean, you look at Jindal and Barber, and they're going to, like, what, not take money for the unemployed? I mean, this is incredible, the kind of, class warfare on their end of things. This approach that I think is just going to crush them in the end. I just can't imagine what kind of strategy is behind that other than class warfare. And the other thing I wanted to ask, though, about is what is it with these Democrats? I mean, these guys, they get put into office because people hate Bush, right? They hate him and they hate the war. But when they come in and they have Clinton disease, as I call it, at least, I mean, you have someone who wants to be loved by everyone in the person of Obama, and you realize increasingly that he's weak on that score and tries to be, quote-unquote, bipartisan, i.e., you know, give them $300 billion before you start talking to them when it's the stimulus package. And he's a corporatist to boot, and he's close with Rubin, who helped, you know, produce the problems we have, and Geithner and Summers.
And all these guys.
Yeah, they're terrible. And the thing I'm really upset about with him about is, you know, he's going into Afghanistan, and he's trying to protect some of the secrets that Bush had militarily. And, you know, I mean, I really like Obama with the idea of raising taxes on the rich. But aside from that, he's got some serious problems, and he's not coming through with the things he promised to do, from what I can tell.
Would you, is there a question here, or just sort of a...
I just wonder what your opinion is of that. I mean, why is it the Democrats, when they have these two successful elections, as you were noting, in which, you know, first time in 7 or 8 years, in which you have such a thumping of the the opponent's party, is it that they think that the public really wants to hear Republican-style rhetoric and just say they'll vote for Democrats because, well, they don't bother to talk about abortion and some other things that are irrelevant at this point?
Yeah, Matt Taibbi?
Yes, first of all, thanks for the call, and I think you've, you know, really hit the nail on the head. People, I think, are going to start to realize that these politicians, you know, both the Republicans and the Democrats, that they have much greater allegiances to each other and to the sort of kind of class of people who run things in Washington. They have a sort of general cultural allegiance to people of their own type. They have much greater allegiances in that direction than they do to their voters, who are people who they really don't hang out with a lot. it's all sort of the same kind of insular group of people running things, and they kind of maybe change seats every few years when this party's out of power and this party's in power. But I think people who expect big changes or who expect the Democrats to respond forcefully to a perceived mandate out there are really mistaken about who these people are and what their values are. I think they are not, that's not what they're about. I think that they use electoral rhetoric to get in power and to recapture their offices, but I don't think they really have a connection to their voters, and I don't think they want to make these changes. It's my impression. I think that it's kind of just the same group of people who play musical chairs every few 4 years, and the policies kind of just don't change, which is really, really frightening. You know, I mean, I don't know how you can bring somebody like Larry Summers back into the fold after all the disastrous sort of deregulation and the policies that he helped pursue in the late 90s, and now he's back right now, you know, in office again. It's to me, it's crazy, and I think people are eventually going to start to hold the Democrats accountable for this kind of stuff, but they never, ever respond to that mandate. You know, especially like in 2006, they had the power to start doing something about the war, and clearly that was what the midterm election was all about. People were overwhelmingly rejecting the war, and they didn't do anything. You know, they stalled. So
let's go back to the phone lines, Matt Taibbi. We have two more callers who are waiting patiently. I want to get them in before we have to go off the air. Let's first go to line two. Urbana, you're on the air with Matt Taibbi.
What is your opinion of Rush Limbaugh? This past week he said, I hope that the stimulus bill blows up in their faces, which tells me that his partisan politics is more important than the safety and prosperity of the citizen, American citizen.
Well, what do you expect? I mean, you know, Rush Limbaugh is not angling for a peace, a Nobel Prize for responsible citizenship. He's out to get ratings and out to stir people up, and he's quite good at that. He's just kind of lousy at doing the right thing. So he's I can't stand the guy, but I think he's really not going to be losing any power with Obama in office. I think it's actually going to strengthen his grip on his listening.
Well, based on that one episode that took place a few weeks ago where the Republican member of Congress criticized Rush Limbaugh and then had to sort of go on the air and apologize
right,
to a national audience, suggests that he's someone who you don't really want to cross.
Exactly. You know, he's got enormous power out there, and if you even saw what John McCain was terrified of the guy the whole campaign last year. And in fact, I think the choice of Sarah Palin was heavily influenced by people like Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all those people. I think they just wanted to throw those people a bone so that they could get them off their back a little bit. So,
Quite a bone it was, too. Let's go to line three for our final caller now. Line three, Champagne, you're on the air with Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine.
Hi, thanks. I just had a quick comment about something you were saying earlier. I think you had talked about how you couldn't understand the pragmatism of the Obama administration's kind of position on the war and continuing the war through 2013. And I just think that I don't think that it's cynical personally. I feel like it's a recognition that even though he wasn't an original supporter of the war, he's now in command of a country which did go to war with another sovereign nation, and whether that war was on, acceptable grounds or not, and I happen to believe very strongly that it was not, now that we've done that and created an extremely unstable and violent situation, I think it's our responsibility to help to try to mitigate that situation. And certainly there can be a lot of disagreements about how to go about that and whether military force is an appropriate or kind of successful solution. But
caller, I hear the bantering of the background, so I want to give Matt Taibbi a chance to let closing comment, Matt, on that or anything else.
I don't know about that. I mean, first of all, I appreciate the comment, but I was in Iraq, and I didn't meet a single Iraqi who didn't think that most of the problems and most of the violence that's happening right now is being caused by our presence there. I mean, I understand the argument that we have to stay there to stabilize the place, but I think
it's a lose-lose situation for everybody. It costs us money and lives to be there, and I think the Iraqis overwhelmingly want us out.
Well, Matt, on that note, I've got to say goodbye to you. I want to thank you so much, Matt Taibbi, for joining us today in Media Matters. And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, and everyone. Have a great week. See you in 1 week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll have clear skies today with a high of 28 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear with a low of 15. Monday, mostly sunny skies with a high of 34 degrees. Clear skies Monday night with a low of 21. And Tuesday, mostly sunny skies with a high of 40 degrees. This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a broadcast service of the College.